So I'd like to thank, of course, the organizers for the nice opportunity to be here. Once again, it is certainly a lovely place. And for giving me the opportunity to talk about materials that have not been discussed most of this week. I do try, however, to show you that there is some interest in these materials as well, for one reason or another. And it's work that has been carried out over the years with various collaborations. One of them, of course, sitting here, Dragana Popovic from the Highfield Lab. I don't think I will have time to discuss most of them, but I will try to show you at least one or two examples of where this effect of spin and charge glassiness shows up. One of them, which I will spend most of my time, and this is where we have concentrated for more years compared to the others, is cuprates. And more recently, we just had a very nice piece of work which came out of heterostructures grown by laser MBE. And also in magnetoelectrics as well. And a year ago or so, we have managed to get some nice papers out on polymerized graphite oxide. But I doubt I will be able to talk. And the work has been funded through various sources throughout the years, depending on the places. So I will start with cuprates, and most of the time I will talk on lanthanum-based cuprate, high-temperature superconductors, not because the others don't show similar effects, simply because this material allows us to at least experimentally observe these effects more vividly. And I will then spend a little bit of time on the heterostructures of transition metal oxides, in particular manganites, and perhaps then on the magnetoelectrics and the graphite oxide. So let me start with the cuprates, and I will show you one of the early motivations of why we did what we are what I'm going to discuss, and what it looked like at the time we started. One of the reasons that we were looking at this problem is because we were thinking, perhaps if you look at the phase diagram of going from an insulator to a superconductor through some kind of phase transition and quantum tuning, perhaps in the presence of inevitable disorder, like in chemically doped cuprates, for example, or other transition metal oxides, even sometimes induced by lattice, you may have some rounding, and the question is what can arise from this rounding, or what can this rounding cause? Now, looking at the phase diagram of the high-temperature superconductors as it has evolved over the years, for those who are not very familiar, the main message here is basically when you tune the starting antiferromagnetic insulator with some quantum control parameter, which could be doping, chemical doping, pressure, or field, then you find for all kinds of high-temperature cuprates that you start with an antiferromagnetic insulator, which then at some point goes away, and through an intermediate stage, which turns out to be glassy-like, and I will be concentrating on this quite a bit, after that, superconductivity, or to be more precise, high-temperature superconductivity emerges. So the question is not why only you can go from an insulator to a superconductor through an intermediate state, but even more surprising to me is that why high-temperature superconductivity appears only after the system has become a spin-glass-like system, or a glassy-like behavior system. Why, for example, this antiferromagnetic system doesn't extend all the way to some quantum critical point, as often is the case that you can see in some of the heavy fermion compounds. Instead, however, between these two phases, the superconducting order and the antiferromagnetic order, the system goes through some kind of disordered phase, and it's highly non-metallic or a strange metal up to very high temperatures. And here is the so-called pseudo-gap line, but in principle it's just a crossover, where the system changes from something non-metallic to something eventually metallic through some intermediate stage. What we have found, and I will be discussing, that in between these two regions there is something which looks more like a relaxer or a glass. Right, so the parent material, and this is actually the one that started the field, lanthanum copper oxide 4, and I have dot, 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 and I will discuss why I mean dot, dot, dot in the end, probably my last transparency of this section, is a layered cuprate. It has one hole per copper 2 plus atom, exchange constant of about 135 MeV. And clearly, as you can see from this side, the spins 1/2 are located at the copper ions, and they form a nearly square lattice with small orthorhombic distortion. There is strong repulsion between the neighboring site, and that makes this material an antiferromagnetic mode insulator. And there is some good evidence that oxygen in between the copper atoms in red shown here mediates some residual magnetic interaction between the neighboring spins. Now, indeed, if you take this single crystal, and what I will be talking about, this is most of the work, if not all of the work that I will be showing today, is on high-quality single crystals. And indeed, after 20 years of work, people have managed to make good single crystals out of these systems. And thanks to some new technology that was developed 10 years ago or 15 years ago by the Japanese. So here is magnetic susceptibility data as a function of temperature for a pure material. And here you can see at approximately 315 degrees Kelvin, a very nice sharp peak at T-nail, which actually, as soon as you start doping it within only 1% strontium in this case, T-nail goes down but persists, and you see some broadening in the transition temperature here. Now, what is interesting is that as soon as you put 1% holes into the system, and indeed, as I mentioned before, you have a T-nail temperature which is relatively high. It's not as 300 and so as it was in the pure compound, but now has dropped to 180 or something. When you do a local probe experiment, and this is experiment by the muon spin relaxation technique, and for those who are not experts, let me just mention a few words. Basically, what you do is you use muons because they have a lifetime of about 2.2 microseconds. It's a bulk probe, you fire it in the system, and they decay, and you pick up the positron that is emitted from the muon. And the positron that comes out carries all the information of the muon at the time of decay. It's basically like a magnetic spy. And you can find that at the nail temperature of this particular sample, for example, there is a very nice frequency response. So you have one component of frequency here. But as you lower down the temperature in this region here, you find a second frequency component, which actually in 1 over T1 shows a very nice sharp peak. So what this is telling you, and over the years it has been repeated to other cuprate families as well, those that you can prepare, is that as soon as with the first dope carriers, you get a second freezing within the nail state. So within your so-called nail order, you have a second order appearing with the first added carriers, as if the carriers that you add freeze themselves. Now, it's very hard to see, and that's why it took a while from the discovery of these materials to see it here, because when you look at your magnetic susceptibility, there's not very much to make you suspicious that something like that could be happening. Keep adding carriers, and the system now with 4% carriers has lost its long-range order, and it looks more like a spin glass. And I will come back to the details of what kind of spin glass this may be, if it is a spin glass. But basically what this is telling you is that actually above 2% added carriers, you see some kind of freezing, and indicates, or at least strongly suggests, that there is a break in time reversal, rotational, and or translational symmetry. Now, this happens just before the material becomes a high-temperature superconductor. So basically, you enter superconductivity from a glassy phase. So if I am to put the data that I showed you before together and draw a revised phase diagram, on the temperature versus chemical doping phase diagram, you have your antiferromagnetism going down, and as soon as you reach 2% doping, you've lost this antiferromagnetism, and you have been replaced now by a spin glass phase shown here. Even though, of course, as I mentioned before, even within this antiferromagnetic phase, as soon as you start adding carriers, you have developed a glassy phase anyway. It's just it's hard to study it as much as you can study it here because you are protected by the antiferromagnetism on the top. So the question is, what happens to this phase as you enter the superconducting dome? Do you get it to coexist with superconductivity? And if it does, how far does it go? And if it has to do anything with any kind of phase transitions in the superconducting order parameter later on? And to do this, unfortunately, you cannot use a thermodynamic method. Yes, please.
You know for sure that it expands all the way until the superconducting thing. There's no reason.
Which one? The glassy phase?
Yeah.
It certainly does. The only thing that one has to point out here is that the length over, or the chemical doping range over which it extends, is material dependent. For example, if your material is more is less disordered, such as, for example, the yttrium, barium, copper oxide family, this region shrinks quite significantly. However, it's still there. If it's the barium case, the bismuth case, sorry, it's relatively long as well, and so on and so forth. But it's universally there. It just shrinks or grows depending on the
direction.
The more ordered the system, the more it shrinks. Oh, you mean it goes, it disappears. It goes this way. It goes this way.
So there is a gap then between spin glass and superconducting?
No, no, you don't have the spin glass. The region over which you have spin glass becomes narrower in doping. So for example, if your system is more ordered, you will have spin glass phase only for a 1% doping region.
So antiparamagnetic is closer
to superconducting. Correct, correct, correct. But there is always a finite small region where spin glass is still there. And but what is important to note here in brackets, however, is that this phase is there anyway. So if you do this experiment that I just mentioned, you have an advantage, that is the MuSR experiment. All these experiments were carried actually at the ICES lab in Oxford. The advantage is that if you use pulsed muons, the pulse is of the order of gigahertz. And then you have another end, which is the lifetime of the muon, which is of the order of microseconds. So that is, you can register the time that something goes slow or turns glassy from something of the order of gigahertz and eventually freezes to the end of your window, which is of the order of mega. So this is basically the red. The red is the first time you see something slowing down, and the blue is the time that you see it freezing within your time window. Now, throughout this talk, we have to remember that the, when I mentioned MuSR, is a time-dependent technique, and so is NMR, and so is neutrons, and so on and so forth. So for anything dynamic like glasses, one has to be careful that we are talking, as far as these techniques are concerned, for some time windows or some crossover temperatures, characteristic temperatures, not transition temperatures, as far as this technique is concerned. So if I am to take, for example, a material which has, let's say, 3% doping, which is precisely in the region where you have only glassy phase, you have no nail temperature and no superconductivity, as you come down in temperature, your system registers, or your experiment registers at approximately 100 Kelvin, some spins to slow down. And eventually, the same spins will freeze at some much lower temperature. In other words, there is a long, as far as a function of temperature, sluggish region where the system slows down towards a glassy phase. And when you do your DC or your AC susceptibility experiment with a few hertz, then your data will be looking with the glassy features down here, right? Because you're approaching the DC limit. Now, if I do this experiment for many dopings, that is all the way across, it turns out that this sluggish region or this glassy phase region, which is the blue, persists and extends all the way to halfway through the superconducting dome. That is where superconductivity is optimal. So that means your superconductivity coexists with this glassy phase. Now, one may have the question, is this long range or is this short range? The experiment can tell you that as far as your technique is concerned, it looks very homogeneous. There's a caveat here, however, is that the technique has a resolution, and the resolution is 2 nanometers, or 20 angstroms. So that means the system is homogeneously glassy within this restriction, which is 2 nanometers. So that means you could have electronic heterogeneity in your system, but not macroscopic heterogeneity in your system. Now, I mentioned before that there is a problem with time-dependent techniques in that what you register may be what you see, but you may not be able to register something that is still there, but your technique cannot pick it up because your time window is limited. There's two ways to go around this in some experiments. One way is, for example, by magnetic field. The other way is by pinning your spins, so you can bring them in earlier to your time window. And there is an advantage in chemistry, however, and material science in these materials, in that if I am to substitute zinc for copper because they are isovalent, and zinc adds no holes to my system because they're both 2+, then I shall be able to do two things, basically kill two birds at a time. That is, I can suppress superconductivity in these D-wave superconductors, that is, reveal the ground state of my system, and at the same time slow down my moments, and therefore, if there is something hiding outside my time window, I shall be able to bring it in. In other words, why do I do this? It's not so much to see how far in temperature I can extend the onset of my glassiness, but how far in doping I can extend the presence of my glassiness in my ground state. So in doing so, what we found is that in the pure compound which I showed you just before, it's represented here by the black line, the glassy phase extended all the way to this doping. But when I added 1% zinc to my sample as a function of doping and I reduced my dome, my superconducting dome. This thing, although it moved up because simply the spin slowed down and therefore they were able to come in when they were slowing down faster than before, come in earlier to my time window, this extended a little bit further. And when I added 2% zinc, it extended slightly further, but not so much. So basically it started,
Is it compensating?
Of the zinc?
Yeah.
Compensating what?
Killing holes, producing.
No. Zinc 2 plus, copper 2 plus, zinc non-magnetic. That's right.
Why is
this? D-wave. All right. So the next thing we did is we played a little bit with material science and we managed to put 5% zinc in the system and kill superconductivity throughout. In other words, we managed to get to reveal the ground state of our system. And we found that indeed, at approximately 20% for this system doping, the glassiness disappears. Anything above 5% zinc phase separates the system and is useless. Now, I have to emphasize here, 20% doping here doesn't mean that in another system it has to be 20%, right? If there's a quantum critical point there, if at all, it can be at any different point for a different material. So that's not the important thing. The important thing is that you focus on one system and you try to get the juice out of it. And it turns out that as far as this system is concerned, the story is that here there is a critical doping above which we lose this glassy-like freezing. And there is some significance to this doping, as I will show you later. Notably, this is not at 16% and a half where TC is maximum. Is at higher doping, where actually the absolute value of the superfluid density is maximum. And when you have systems such as the cuprates, where low-dimensional systems like this with short coherence length, defining TC is quite hard, and using TC as your optimal superconductivity is a little bit on the dangerous side. Whereas a ground state property such as the superfluid density is probably more precise. So, I mentioned about glassiness, and it would be nice to actually use some more detailed analysis to identify what kind of glassiness are we talking about. Unfortunately, we cannot do what I'm going to be discussing now in the superconducting state, and it's not fair to do it also when you have such a huge amount of zinc in, but we can actually do the test before the system becomes a superconductor. So in other words, is it really a glass and does it obey the or follow the standard behavior that we have learned to do? So let me take the 3%. So this is, so far I showed you 2% and 4% doped data. This is 3%. So this is a single crystal of strontium 3% in the lanthanum strontium copper oxide material. And this is data measured at 200 Gauss. This is zero field cool data compared to field cool. And if you actually check at the Edward Sanders order parameter, and this is data as I increase the magnetic field up to 6 Tesla, it shows a very nice behavior. And sorry, the line something changed. Actually, this is the TG. And we get a TG of approximately 10 or 9 Kelvin. And the Vita is about 0.8, which is not too bad. Also, if you measure magnetization as a function of time in the glassy phase, it has a very nice time dependence with a stressed exponential behavior with 1 over 3 exponent, which again is not so bad. You have a beautiful remnant magnetization in the glassy phase, shown a hysteresis all the way up to 3 Tesla, and a beautiful scaling relation. So if you have to look at it from the mean field sense, it follows everything nice. So you would be happy to say this is a nice, beautiful spin glass. On the other hand, it may not be exactly like that, because this is encouraging, but maybe doesn't tell us everything about whether this is a glass or not. But nevertheless, it's something which is glassy-like. That is for sure. So what have I learned out of this? Well, one thing is that indeed, this glassy-like behavior, yes? This is a DC, the data that I showed you, although now we have AC, just not unpublished. This is DC magnetization. So we get apply a magnetic field, and we increase the applied magnetic field up to a certain value. So we extract it using DC magnetization measurements from M over. So basically, instead of sweeping only frequency, you can sweep applied DC magnetic field. Sorry? You can get Q out of that. I can refer you to the first paper published that. That was in 1992 by FC Chu in PRL. That was the first attempt. So let me now tell you what I have probably learned from this work, is that indeed we all know that closing after the transition, the standard spin glass transition, the system will behave classically. Now, if, however, I'm able to reduce the temperature low enough, then the system will shrink its classical region, and I might get quantum phase transition. What we have done actually is something different. What we have done is that we have worked throughout at 30 millikelvin or 20 millikelvin, and instead of tuning temperature, we tuned a quantum tuning parameter being the carrier concentration. So in other words, what we did is we took this behavior and we crossed it across, we take it across here as a function of doping. And looking at this diagram and the combination of these two sets of data, it seems that we managed to go from a glassy-like behavior to a paramagnet. Because indeed, here if we do also a standard magnetization experiment, the system is a very beautiful paramagnet. So basically, you go from a glassy-like state to a paramagnetic state at almost equal zero, or at least 30 millikelvin that we conduct our experiments. So that means that this phase transition here at t equals zero was most likely to be a quantum mechanical. But it cannot be a quantum critical point because it's intercepted by disorder, so it's most likely to be something like a quantum glass transition. So the message here is that we may be looking at a quantum glass transition in these doped MOT insulators, or expecting to see a quantum glass transition rather than a quantum critical point, as may be the case in pure systems such as 3D heavy fermions. Moreover, the question one can ask now is that, okay, I have defined this sluggish region where it starts, the, all my moment starts slowing down to something glassy at the end. What happens to the charge? Is the charge involved, or is it not listening to it, and therefore I can get superconductivity in some other regions? And this is the next step. So the first thing that we noticed is that when we did in-plane resistivity and other colleagues as well around the world as a function of temperature, for these samples, which are purely glassy and not superconducting, the system goes from something metallic to insulating like at lower temperatures. There is a minimum at every single curve, and if I take the minima, and I indicate it here by green data, the minima fall pretty nicely to my sluggish region. They don't have to, because this is a DC resistivity technique and this is an AC experiment. But at least there is a trend. So when we took one of these data, which was traditionally, and including ourselves, measured down to 1 Kelvin, and we measured it down to 50 millikelvin for the first time, we realized that below 200 millikelvin, the resistance shoot up several orders. So that actually drew my attention, and we decided to investigate it even further and find out what does this mean. It turns out that it's a very beautiful variable range hopping, and this is work now we have started, actually we did it for the past 3 or 4 years together with Dragana Popovic and Ivana Rajcevic, and it follows a beautiful power law. So we decided to look at it into more detail in this region, and the first experiment we did some time ago, one of my students, is measure capacitance. And we realized that as we lower the temperature down, there is a nice, beautiful broadening of the distribution of relaxation frequencies in my system. And this happens no matter which way I apply my electric field. This is at zero magnetic field. So my glassy-like sample, the one that showed the beautiful glassy characteristics both in the MuSR and the susceptibility, shows this very beautiful broadening in relaxation frequencies. And the peak frequency decreases as the temperature is lowered. So it seems that the charge is feeling something, but it doesn't feel it at 10 degrees Kelvin where the spin does. It does it only at an order or so magnitude lower. So we can only see this behavior below 100 or so millikelvin rather than below 10 Kelvin. As you cross 10 Kelvin, the charge seems to feel nothing. So that was the interesting part. And then we realized that we may need to do actually noise experiments here. So we struggled for a year or so in getting the samples the right shape and then making sure they are not cracked. Because for those who are not in the field, these are bulk single crystals that can grow up to millimeters. So if you wish to have them in micrometers or a fraction of a millimeter, you have to do quite a bit of a work to get them right. So here you can see noise data. So what I'm showing you here is relative fluctuation of resistance as a function of time, and the traces are shifted just vertically for clarity. You can see that it's only below 200 millikelvin that noise starts becoming apparent, and here I have expanded the region of the data at 60 millikelvin. You can see some very nice spectrum here. And already? Well, okay, next year. So, and this is something, some more details out of the data of the noise that we have measured. What I'm showing you here is octave average power spectra at different temperatures. So here is the low temperature shown in red, and the high temperature shown in purple, and the solid lines are just linear fits to 1 over f alpha. Down here, I'm showing you a plot again from the data that the data shown as a function of temperature and also as a function of applied magnetic field for a given temperature. So you can see that the values of the power spectrum shown here at 1 millihertz as a function of temperature are more or less same, and there is very little, if any, field dependence. Alpha, the exponent, here shows a very strong temperature dependence, but very little, if any, field dependence, at least as up to 8 tesla. So what we find is that the magnitude of the noise is independent both of temperature and magnetic field, at least within the noise level of experiment, while the exponent alpha increases as the temperature is reduced and is independent of the applied magnetic field. I have to mention again that the data in the field were taken well below the temperature where we see the noise that is already at 100 and so millikelvin. I have to skip this one for the second spectrum. So the question is, okay, it looks like if I focus up here, I see very beautiful glassy-like characteristics also from my charge sector, only that I see these at temperatures significantly lower to where my spin freezes. So what happens as a function of doping? Do we continue to see this trend? Well, you cannot do the same experiment I just mentioned in the superconducting state, but at least we get a feeling by looking at published data what happens if you suppress superconductivity to the metal insulator transition. And it turns out that it follows exactly the same doping dependence as the glass does. What also is interesting is that at the point where we see the system turning from, this is data from Greg Bominger from the Highfield lab, at this point, precisely, resistivity is linear in temperature all the way to the highest temperature ever measured. This is actually very important to notice, is that you have linear resistivity all the way up to 800 degrees Kelvin. Now, this is not so trivial, I think, for something like this. And the system beyond this doping starts developing a power law closer to Fermi liquid. That's right. This is the minimum. Correct. And this is the sample that this is the sample that I showed you before the noise data. So this is unpublished data. This is ongoing work. So actually, this took the curiosity out of me because I was wondering: is doping necessary, or are these materials ever really undoped? So we asked our friends to make us a crystal as good as they can, and they managed to make us a single crystal of the lanthanum copper oxygen 4 with the least ever oxygen doping entering it. You can never really make these systems ever oxygen 4. They always have some little oxygen in them. And it turns out this is the reason you never see a nail temperature which is 325 or above. They are always 320 or something like that. So we managed to get the lowest nail temperature, the highest nail temperature ever in this cuprate family, with carrier concentration as determined by Hall effect at room temperature, one order of magnitude lower than ever published before. So basically, the system is really as undoped as it can be. And we were surprised to find that our dielectric constant had a huge anomaly and a peak at around 40 Kelvin. So as soon as charge enters this system for reasons that are beyond our control, because simply if we prepare them in very high vacuum, the material breaks, so it's useless. The material shows very strong relaxation behavior in the charge. So that means that it's intrinsically inherent to actually invite glassiness within the first carriers, as far as that even the charge is concerned. And allow me a couple of minutes, if I may, to summarize and show you the next bit, because at least the next section, a couple of transparencies, because I think is useful. So in summary, phase transitions involving breaking of spatial symmetries are rounded by disorder, and this leads to frequency-dependent transition temperatures. And in our experience, it seems that this seems to be quite generic and robust in the cuprates. And at the moment, we have more noise and dielectric experiments near the superconducting onset topping regime. So basically, what we are tackling now is systems with very low TC, materials with very low TC, where we can suppress superconductivity and look at the noise spectrum. In other words, be really within the superconducting region. The next section I would like to talk, this is something that I've been very excited over the past couple, 3 or 4 years, and we just got a couple of interesting papers out, is transition metal oxide heterostructures. These are beautiful systems because basically you can get all kinds of transition metal oxides, stick them together, and you can get emergent properties at the interface which are far beyond to what you can imagine in the bulk material. For example, you can have two antiferromagnets put together and your interface can be a nanometer or 2 nanometers thick and be ferromagnetic metal. Or you can have actually two insulators put together, such as this case, and your interface can become even a superconductor under certain conditions. So we have played many games and we have actually found some interesting properties, but one of them related to this conference is glassiness. So I was not surprised actually to find what we found, but basically we did the experiments just for the fun of it and it turns out beautiful. It has been reported that if you take two antiferromagnetic manganites, a G-type and an A-type, and you put them together, the material shows very beautiful metallic behavior, strong magnetoresistance, as well both metallic in resistivity and in magnetization. And there has not been a real understanding of why. Why would you get out of two antiferromagnets a nice, beautiful ferromagnetic metal on the interface? The question I had myself actually was, is it really so nice metal and is it really ferromagnetic, or could actually we have some frustration, for example? I could easily have Jalonyski-Moria when I break symmetry into this into systems of this kind. And we asked our friends in Korea to make us some beautiful heterostructures in Seoul, and they made us some very beautiful thin films. These are neodymium manganese, strontium manganese, and lanthanum manganese. So here is the details of the structure. And what happens is Jiwon, actually, this, my student who did part of his PhD on this, was very pessimistic, and she submitted it to PRB, and they were kind enough to upgrade it to RapidCom without us asking. Usually, it's, you have to fight for months for something, but anyway. This is synchrotron X-ray diffraction of the various heterostructures they have prepared for us. Atomic force microscopy, this is from 0 to 5 micrometers, 0 to 1 nanometer, so you can see a very beautiful and nice surfaces and interfaces from the read and from the in-situ high-energy electron diffraction. And what we found is that we did two kinds of experiments on these particular films, neutron reflectometry and magnetization, and now we are planning to do some transport as well. We found that there is a very, again, a hysteretic dependence in the susceptibility, which follows exactly or very, very much the behavior that we saw in the strontium-doped LSEO. Very beautiful glassy behavior. And the glassy transition turns out to be approximately 36, and the critical exponents we get out of this is 0.7 and 1.95, which is not bad at all. Now, the beautiful part of this is that this region is confined in approximately 2 or so nanometers thick interface. So that means you have very nice metastable and memory behavior in a confined self-made interface or region by the material. And it would be nice, the next step which we are working on, to see what happens to the charge. Because it would be beautiful if we can actually have the charge show us nice memory effects. Even more exciting than just being metallic. And we don't...
What's the conductivity of
The conductivity as published so far is shown here. It's ohm centimeters. So I will not be surprised at all. Again, we have some nice time-dependent behavior. So basically what we have done is we have taken the sample down to 10 Kelvin after cooling it in 0.1 Tesla, and we looked at it as a function of time, and it has a very beautiful exponential-like behavior with an exponent of 0.7, again, reasonable. And also in another behavior, as we basically cooled it to 10 Kelvin and had a 0.1 Tesla and measured the magnetization as we weighted as a function of time. And it turns out that when we do neutron reflectometry into the system, we have two kinds of Bragg peaks. We have actually very beautiful Bragg peaks here, and the difference between R plus and R minus in our reflectometry indicates that we have magnetic modulation in our heterostructure. And what it indicates, in short, is that the relaxer behavior that we observed and I just mentioned at the interface may therefore be due to some competitive interaction between the ferromagnetism at the interface and the antiferromagnetism far from it, that is where the bulk material is. But for one reason or another, it's beautiful to have it made automatically for you. And this is a summary for this. And I have overrun, so I apologize. Thank you.
I noticed you saw more glossy behavior in year 1/8. That's got to do with the stripes?
It has to do with the locking. Because there is a structural transition. Oh, well, for this material, it's not a structural transition, but there is ample evidence, as you know, for the stripes becoming static, and that will give rise to then to the glossy temperature and also the glossy characteristics. It's even more amplified in the barium-doped sample, where you actually have a structural transition pinning whatever fluctuates, if it stripes or something else.
Very nice talk.
Thank you.
Let me see how much controversy we can stir up here.
Why not?
About few percent doping, you say that once you suppress superconductivity, you reveal the true ground state. Do you want to speculate about whether the glass is the superconducting state is the driver or the driven? That is a glassy dynamic somehow instrumental to forming the superconducting state, or they compete, or the superconducting state has something to do with the glassy state? Is there any causal connection between the two, or they just happen to exist nearby?
Certainly there is a connection.
That's where I'm trying to stir things up.
So I would like to believe that there's more than just a connection. The reason is that, as I mentioned before, this so-called dead region where you have no order, either superconducting or antiferromagnetic, seems to be there most of the time, or all the time, before high temperature superconductivity emerges. What's always, is also interesting is that if you look at some of the heavy fermion compounds, in particular the 2D, two-dimensionality, for example, is good for erasing high TC. So that may not be the only, maybe one of the reasons why these materials have a high TC. But it turns out that actually sometimes you can add disorder and your TC can go higher, even in some of the heavy fermions. And this is actually quite interesting. I don't claim or nor even understand how could this actually lead to superconductivity. How can you get order out of disorder? But I'm not so sure whether this, what we call a spin glass in the cuprate society, is a spin glass. It's some kind of a relaxer. And what we are aiming at all these years, as far as this project is concerned, is try to understand what kind of a relaxer.
My question is about glass transport of glassy phase. You were talking about variable range hopping. I remember that Mark Kastner and colleagues studied this approximately 3% or 2%,
indeed,
and they got 1/2 and in you know, Epershkovsky law, and in very long range of parameters, so large dynamic range.
I'm not so sure that they really got 1/2. I think they got 1/3. But let me actually make sure, it could be 1/2. But one thing that I have to make clear here is that these experiments were conducted at temperatures that were not conducted in the past. We went down.
Oh, this is very close to transition, so to say.
These are very low temperatures. These
very
are
low
no
temperatures, and
correct.
That's why.
Correct. No one has measured before.
Of course, they measured much larger temperatures.
Correct.
I'm sure. Not only they, there was several papers on
what is.
On
that's
there.
What I found surprising.
And they converged on 1/2.
For many years, even up to 3 years, 4 years ago, that we did these early experiments for very low temperatures, high TC community was using Dill fridges. But no one ever showed some data below 1K or 0.5K or something like that. But there you go. When you do measure it, then you see 1/3.
Yeah, probably it was a smaller percentage, more insulating.
That's right.
System.
Correct.
I have a question. Maybe I missed something. So when you measure the implant resistivity, low AB, how do you get into the superconductive region? I mean, in the superconductive region, you have you don't have a zero resistivity.
So the noise data and the dielectric data that I showed are in the non-superconducting regime, are at dopings where the material is not a superconductor. At the dopings where the material is a superconductor, the way to see the power law in the resistivity, not the noise, the power law in the resistivity is to apply 60 or 70 Tesla field, kill superconductivity, and measure the transport all the way to the lowest temperature. There is a problem there that heating will not allow you to measure below 100 or 200 millikelvin. Therefore, direct comparison is very difficult. What we are trying to do now is actually use some beautiful samples where we are just at the onset of superconductivity at 5.5% doping, not that high, or at least it's possible with a high DC magnetic field in the lab to suppress it and therefore do the experiments that I showed you for the non-superconducting sample, but in an originally superconducting sample.
Okay, if we don't have question, let's send the speaker. Our next speaker is Jagana Popovich from Florida State University.